It's good to be back in Waterloo. So I'd like to thank the speakers for the invitation. So I'll be talking today about joint work with Jingyi Chen and Weiyong He, both at UBC. And so I'll be talking about the mean curvature flow, in particular Lagrangian mean curvature flow for entire Lagrangian graphs. So the Lagrangian mean curvature flow in general has been studied for some time, and the mean curvature flow, of course. On the other hand, in the case of entire Lagrangian graphs in CN, as we'll see, the equations reduce to a nice fully nonlinear parabolic PDE for just a real function on Rn. And in this case, there are some interesting geometric and just pure PDE questions to investigate, which is what our work focuses on. So throughout the talk, submanifolds, ambient manifolds will all be Euclidean spaces. Submanifolds will mostly all be graphs of entire functions. And over here, I just wanted to just write down the outline of the topics I'll be talking about. It'll get a little technical somewhere along the way. So I'll begin by introducing the mean curvature flow equations, which we'll be using, and then specialize this to the case of Lagrangian and Lagrangian mean curvature flows. Then I'll review some past results on both of these, and then introduce our main results with proofs following that, depending on the time I have. So to begin with, let me introduce the mean curvature flow in our context. So we start with a function from Rn to Rm, and we consider the corresponding graph in Rn plus m, namely the embedding taking x to x f of x. Consider this graph in Rn plus m. Then one can consider evolving this submanifold by the mean curvature flow, namely df dt is f changes in the direction of its mean curvature flow, and at time zero, the initial embedding is given by this initial embedding here. So we have, here's Rn, and let's say this is the mean curvature vector, the scalar mean curvature times the normal vector. So, So this is an evolution of embeddings. It describes given a solution to this, it describes a family of submanifolds evolving to this equation, emerging from your initial submanifold. The equation makes perfect sense for any embedding in Rn plus m, any initial submanifold, in which case, if it's a compact submanifold in the ambient space, it's actually the gradient flow for the volume functional with respect to the induced metric on the submanifold. In any case, let me draw this a little more normal looking. In any case, in our context, so specifically, when this submanifold is the graph of an entire function, like so, then this evolution of submanifolds, of graphs, can be described by an equivalent equation whereby we just evolve the graphing function. So an equivalent expression of this evolution, at least geometrically, is the following equation, graphical mean curvature flow. So here, F star of. Gij here represents the metric induced from the Euclidean space by this embedding, the pullback metric onto Rn. It's a family of metrics. And here, this Fij is just second partial derivatives of the multi-value function F. So this is a nice parabolic system for F. And in this case, we're evolving the graphing function in the vertical direction, but it describes the same flow of submanifolds in the sense that given an initial embedding, which is the graph of an initial function, given a solution to both these equations, there always exists a family of diffeomorphisms from Rn to itself, such that the embedding given by solution to mean curvature flow at time t is essentially the graph of f at time t here, where we just reparametrize by this time-dependent diffeomorphism. So in this sense, these two are equivalent. Okay. But notice that both of these are systems, essentially, on Rn, parabolic systems. Okay, so now we come to the Lagrangian case. Now, in the case that the ambient manifold, Rn plus m, is just Cn, so this, of course, you can have two copies of Rn identified like this, then there are some canonical holomorphic objects or objects induced by the holomorphic structure on Cn. So we always have a natural holomorphic coordinate, an I in here, natural holomorphic coordinate on the total space. We can think of the x1 to xn's and the y's as coordinating each of these factors in this notation. We also have a natural symplectic form using these coordinates. And then, of course, there's always the holomorphic structure tensor J, which expresses the holomorphic structure of Cn. And this is just the automorphism from tangent spaces to tangent spaces at a point described as follows. So the I coordinate vector goes like this. And okay. So when the ambient space is Cn, we have these objects. And I'll make the following definition. Of course, this definition makes sense in more generality. But like I said, I just want to restrict to the case we're looking at and make it simple for the time being. So a submanifold in Cn is Lagrangian, namely if it's a half real dimensional submanifold. Cn is 2n dimensional. And when the ambient symplectic form restricts to be zero on the submanifold. So there's a Lagrangian submanifold in Cn. Now there are some following geometric consequences of this condition. The first is that if we take any tangent vector to our submanifold and we hit it with the complex structure tensor, then this is another vector, and this will be perpendicular to L. And this is for all tangent vectors to L. Another geometric consequence of the Lagrangian condition here is that one can consider the following holomorphic N form, the ambient holomorphic N form, restricted to L. This will give you the induced volume form on the submanifold up to a constant complex number at every point, which is just has modulus 1. So in fact, these are can be taken to characterize Lagrangians. They're equivalent conditions, each of these. In any case, on L, we have a nice canonical function theta, real function, and one fact we have is that the mean curvature vector on the Lagrangian can be expressed as just J times the gradient of this function. Okay, so in particular, let me just say before I look specifically at the entire graphical case, L being special Lagrangian, namely minimal and Lagrangian, can be expressed nicely in terms of this function as just requiring it to be a constant. Okay, then H is 0, minimal, namely H is 0. So let me come now to the case of entire. So by an entire Lagrangian submanifold in CN, I simply mean a Lagrangian submanifold in CN, which is in fact just the graph of a function f from Rn to Rn, where the domain is coordinated by the x coordinates and the range by the y coordinates, and x plus iy is the canonical holomorphic coordinate on the total space. So the significance here is that when such an entire graph in CN is Lagrangian, then namely satisfies that condition, one works out that that's equivalent to f having a global potential u, an underlying potential, just a real value function. Okay. And correspondingly, if we the graphical mean curvature flow, or the graphical mean curvature flow for this for such an initial function f, corresponds to a nice fully nonlinear evolution equation, parabolic evolution equation for the underlying potential u, which is the equation that we focus on. So, namely, the evolution equation for the potential underlying the graphical mean curvature flow is given by the following. Take the log of following quotient. On top, we have determinant identity plus I times the Hessian of u, and determinant identity plus the square of the Hessian. Okay. So this is the equation we're interested in. It's a evolution equation for a function u, starting with an initial function on u is just a function on Rn. And the point is that given an initial u naught, a potential for an initial entire Lagrangian, if u of xt solves this for some time, then that's equivalent to the gradient of u flowing by graphical mean curvature flow, or equivalently, up to tangential diffeomorphisms, this family of submanifolds in CN will be flowing by the mean curvature flow. Okay, so we reduce our study to studying this fully nonlinear equation for functions. So actually this, believe it or not, is a real number, the right-hand side. It's a nice operator. one sees that the numerator, that this determinant is really the, so this is like the local expression on Rn of this holomorphic n form. The denominator is really the coefficient of the volume form. So the quotient is ei theta, is this angle ei times this angle, and we take the log of it and divide by I. So this is really, I'll call this operator f of Hessian from now on. This operator is the angle, this canonical angle on a Lagrangian. In particular, when the angle is constant, du dt is constant, well, the corresponding solution, f of xt, is just going to be a stationary submanifold in Cn, not moving by the mean curvature flow. Indeed, it's going to be minimal in that case. In any case, requiring f of d squared u to equal a constant is the equation for this entire Lagrangian graph to be minimal in Cn. So this is the equation for special Lagrangian, special entire Lagrangian graphs in Cn. Okay. So before going further, I just wanted to look a little closer at this operator f. Given any function, at any point, we diagonalize the Hessian by a orthogonal change of coordinates, linear change of coordinates at that point. And in these coordinates, if the Hessian is diagonal with entries lambda I, then we see that, in fact, this operator is 1 over I log the product of 1 plus I lambda j, product over j, is this. Now, this expression is just easily seen to be a unit complex number. It's e to the I something, and that something is, in fact, arctan. Just geometrically, you see, it's arctan lambda j. So we take the log of the product and divide by I. We just recover the sum of the arctangents of the eigenvalues of the Hessian. So in terms of the eigenvalues of d squared u, which is what's important, this operator is, in fact, quite nice. In particular, you see that differentiating by any of the lambda j's, you just recover this strictly positive number, which is, so this operator is a strictly this is a strictly parabolic equation, or this is a strictly elliptic operator, if you will. It's, in fact, uniformly elliptic when the Hessian is bounded, right? So it's a strictly parabolic equation with initial conditions having bounded Hessians. So this is the equation we're interested in, and we're interested in seeing for what initial conditions u do we have long time solutions to this evolution equation, and what kind of geometric interpretations can we make, or what kind of geometric consequences are there of such a solution in terms of the mean curvature flow and Lagrangian submanifolds. So let me move describe some previous results on mean curvature flow in general for entire graphs and Lagrangian mean curvature flow. So the first classic theorem of Huiskin and Ecker. Just for graphical mean curvature flow, and the theorem says, we start off with some function on Rn, just real valued, which is just Lipschitz, locally Lipschitz. Then with this alone than the graphical mean curvature flow. Has a long time. Then the graphical mean curvature flow has a long time solution with initial condition F. So we start off with any Lipschitz hypersurface in graphical hypersurface in Rn plus 1, then long time smooth. Then it immediately becomes smooth under the mean curvature flow, and you can flow it for all time. It goes on to say, moreover, actually, so if the gradient of F is bounded, or just the Lipschitz norm of F is uniformly bounded, so the slope of the initial submanifold is initially bounded, then in fact all the derivatives of F for L greater than or equal to 2, all the derivatives of F decay in time. And in particular, the submanifolds are getting flatter as time goes to infinity. And subsequently, you'll actually get a convergence to planes, not necessarily unique along the different subsequences. So anyways, let me make the following remark about Ruskin-Eckers theorem. So first remark, this was later generalized, Evans and Spruck to just continuous initial hypersurfaces in Rn plus 1, entire graphical hypersurface. They're smooth for all time by the mean curvature flow. On the other hand, there exists minimal Lipschitz, entire graphs in R7 of codimension 3. This is these examples due to Lawson-Osterman. So in particular, it's Lipschitz. On the other hand, it's minimal, so it's stationary under the mean curvature flow. So the mean curvature flow does not always smooth Lipschitz initial data. Even in the entire graphical case, as we see here. So having said that, in the compact case, which is the only time I'll mention compact case for the rest of the talk, theorem of Mutow-Wang says that if we're in the compact situation where we have a compact submanifold in an ambient Riemannian manifold with bounded geometry, complete Riemannian manifold with bounded geometry, and we have sufficiently small Lipschitz. So when around every point in the submanifold we can find a uniformly large ambient ball in which the submanifold is described by just the graph of a function having uniformly small Lipschitz constant, in this case, then the mean curvature flow always exists for short time and smooths the submanifold. So then mean curvature flow has short time smooth solution. Okay. That's arbitrary, just any dimension or in codimension. Okay. So finally, before stating our results, a very important theorem just for minimal entire Lagrangians for us is the following theorem of Yuen. It's a Bernstein-type theorem saying that under certain conditions there are no non-trivial entire minimal Lagrangians. And this theorem says, so if U take a smooth function on Rn satisfying this operator on U is constant, namely the special Lagrangian equation. So given an initial smooth entire Lagrangian graph, special Lagrangian graph, such that the Hessian is between the identity and minus the identity, so the eigenvalues are between minus 1 and 1, well, then the conclusion is, then this graph is trivial. It's just a flat plane in Cn. So in terms of u, you just say that implies u is quadratic. So the gradient graph, x du of x, is just, it's just a linear function, and it's just a plane. So there are no entire minimal Lagrangians satisfying this condition, no non-trivial ones. Okay, so this theorem will play a key role in our proof, as we'll see. But so we come to our main results, and our first result is kind of in the spirit of Huiskin-Eckers' theorem. It says essentially that if you start off with a Lipschitz entire Lagrangian graph in Cn with a suitable control on the Lipschitz norm, then there's a long time smooth solution satisfying similar decay estimates. The Lagrangians run for all time under the flow and they get flatter. So specifically, in terms of the potential, we start off with an initial potential, and the Hessian is initially an L infinity, such that the following is true. So like Yuan's Hessian condition, but so in the L infinity sense, the eigenvalues of the Hessian are strictly between 1 and minus 1. So here delta is like this. Then the potential equation for the graphical mean curvature flow has a long time solution. And this has long time solution. The solution is smooth for all positive times. The graphs are immediately smoothed, and going back to time zero, well, locally, back to time zero, certainly the initial condition in space is C11, just by the hypothesis, and put a 1 here in the time slot just means it's the solution converges back to the initial condition in the Lipschitz norm. Okay, so there's a long time smooth solution for positive times. And moreover, like I said, we have these decay estimates. The submanifolds are getting flatter. So such that, so first of all, this condition here, let me call it H for condition on the Hessian, such that this Hessian condition is preserved for all time, and all the derivatives of u, so in particular, this means the Hessian of u is bounded for all time. For derivatives higher, third derivatives and higher, all the derivatives decay in time like this for L greater than or equal to 2, okay, for some constant depending only on the order of the derivative and this constant delta in this initial condition. So that's our first main theorem. In particular, so as a remark, so up to reparametrizing, so this family of submanifolds is flowing for all time under the mean curvature flow. And what's it emerging from? The initial submanifold, well, d squared u and L infinity is just saying that this initial graph is, it's a Lipschitz, initial Lipschitz graph in CN. This is a bound on the Lipschitz norm of the initial submanifold, the initial graph, and it flows under the mean curvature flow for all time and is getting flatter. So in the spirit of Huiskin-Eckers result. So sometime after we had finished this paper, Chen and Chow, who was a graduate student at UBC, they had established actually uniqueness of existence and uniqueness of solutions to this equation in the category of continuous viscosity solutions. So they established existence, uniqueness of continuous viscosity solutions to this equation. So given any such, in particular, initial data, where the Hessian is in L infinity, so this solution we produce is the unique solution. So in particular, with uniqueness and such a long-time existence result, you get almost for free, which is not the way we did it. Like I said, this came after we finished our paper. But then what we get immediately is a Bernstein-type result for translating solutions to Lagrangian mean curvature flow. So in particular, if you suppose that you have a solution to graphical mean curve, you have a solution to Lagrangian mean curvature flow where these conditions are satisfied, yet it's just translating under the mean curvature flow. Well, on the one hand, if it's just translating, all the curvatures will not move. They'll stay constant in time. On the other hand, if it satisfies these conditions, by our theorem, it says all the curvatures essentially have to decay to zero as time goes to infinity. These two solutions have to be unique by uniqueness. Therefore, the only way this happens is when the initial translator was flat. So we get immediately a Bernstein-type theorem combining uniqueness and our theorem. Like I said, one doesn't have to use uniqueness in this argument, but doing that, one immediately sees that you say, if U satisfies the following equation, so gradient U dot some constant vector minus some vector dot x is equal to C, for some constant vectors a, b, and some constant c, then the corresponding Lagrangian graph is just flat. So then U, in terms of the potential, U is just quadratic. Okay. So what I wrote down here is basically, after saying all that, this is the condition for the corresponding Lagrangian graph to generate a translating solution to the mean curvature flow, this condition here. So it's like a generalization, if you will, of what I just erased, the equation for a minimal entire Lagrangian graph. So in fact, let me use just 1 minute to derive this equation here. So to see that equation, translating solutions, one supposes that you have a solution to the graphical mean curvature flow. Equivalently, U is evolving according to our equation there. And you assume simultaneously that given the initial submanifold, translating along some constant vector AB, you assume simultaneously solves the mean curvature flow. So equating these two, so putting x plus AT in the argument here, you have these. And differentiating this equation in time and evaluating at time zero, you get the whole thing as a total derivative as follows. A plus ut. Differentiate this in time is just b. I can express that certainly as total derivative of b dot x. And then I take off the derivative up to a constant on both sides. And on this side, I have ut, which is, this is at time zero. So this is just f of operator f of d squared u naught plus. So I get the equation that I have there, the elliptic equation. So that's the equation for a potential to generate a translating solution to the entire translating solution to the Lagrangian mean curvature flow in CN. So we have this Bernstein theorem here for no non-trivial. I'm sorry. If this satisfies this equation and satisfies this condition on the Hessian, then the only option is for u to be quadratic. Okay, so those are our main theorems, and I'd like to talk now about the proofs of the first theorem, in fact. So as with all geometric evolution equations, the proof, it boils down to establishing the a priori estimates, the needed a priori estimates. And so we have our equation. And in the L infinity sense, let me just write this all again. Some delta between 0 and 1. So the eigenvalues of the initial Hessian are strictly between 1 and minus 1. Now, assume I'm establishing a priori estimates, so I assume I have a solution, a smooth solution existing already. In fact, up to time capital T. In fact, I'll assume more that for all T and L greater than, for all T and L greater than or equal to 2, I assume that the Lth derivative of U is bounded in terms by some constant depending possibly on L and T in particular. So we assume we have a smooth solution with this initial condition, and we just assume that all the derivatives at any time of the function are bounded. Okay, then we want to see what more can we say just based on the fact that it satisfies the equation. So what are the a priori estimates we can establish for this solution? So first of all, let me so again, the embedding ft of x will be, so this will be the corresponding family of submanifolds evolving by mean curvature flow, and embedding from Rn to Cn. Now we'll pull back the following, consider the following two tensors, time-dependent tensors on Rn, just certainly standard, consider the pullback of the Euclidean metric, so just the induced metric on Rn. Let me just write it. This is the pullback of Fi, Fj of Euclidean metric. And another not so standard tensor we'll consider is we consider the pullback of this tensor in Cn, Vdar dot W. This is the ambient Euclidean metric. So this is F star of Fi R F J. So the tensor S, so this is standard, the, where's my brush? Tensor G is standard. The Tensor S, on the other hand, this was not so standard. This was first considered by Smocek in actually in the compact case. So in particular, Smocek, one of the things he considered was he considered entire Lagrangian graphs in CN, running the mean curvature flow for these. But he considered the special case where these are specifically universal covers of compact Lagrangian submanifolds. And he considered this tensor. And turns out that controlling this tensor, as he showed, is very useful for controlling U, for producing a priori estimates for U. So we established the following a priori estimates. So first let me say, to get a better picture of what these tensors are, at any point in space-time, suppose we diagonalize the Hessian. So if at any point in time we diagonalize the Hessian, have diagonal entries lambda j, then gij will in fact simultaneously diagonalize s and g, and gij will have diagonal entries 1 plus lambda j squared, and s will have diagonal entries 1 minus lambda j. Okay, so let me say what our estimates are in terms of these tensors S and G, and then interpret them in so far as what they tell us about U. So the first estimate says, preserved for all T if holds, says that for some positive epsilon, so if our tensor S is initially uniformly positive, then it says it continues to be uniformly positive for all T under our flow. Okay. So I'll interpret this in a second, but our second a priori estimate says that there exists a constant mu depending only on delta in our initial condition there, on the Hessian of U, there exists a positive constant mu such that this tensor minus this tensor, I'm sorry, I should have a bigger than or equal to zero here. But there exists a positive constant mu depending only on delta so that this tensor is uniform, well, is non-negative for all times on Rn. Okay. So what does this tell us in terms of, given the definitions of G and S in terms of U? Well, that's the mean curvature form. Take the mean curvature vector and lower the indices with respect to G. So in particular, you look at the diagonal entries of S and G, and you see that the only way that S can be uniformly bigger than G is if the eigenvalues lambda j are in absolute value uniformly less than 1. So in particular, this estimate in terms of S being bigger than epsilon g implies eigenvalues uniformly less than 1 for the evolving Hessian, and that's basically preserving our condition here. So this translates to H condition for Hessian U naught preserved along the flow. In particular, certainly, that tells you that the Hessian is uniformly bounded along the flow. So that's our first a priori estimate. Now we look to the second one. We have Sij bigger than T mu Hi Hj. If we trace that with G, G upper ij, this produces the following. The norm of the mean curvature form, so just the square norm of the mean curvature itself, is less than or equal to C over T, where C is basically given by the trace of this tensor S. On the other hand, looking at what this is, S is the pullback under F. I should have T. S is the pullback of a constant coefficient tensor in CN, G is the pullback of constant coefficient of the Euclidean metric tensor on Cn. So in Cn, S is certainly a bounded tensor with respect to the Euclidean metric. So we pull it back along anything. The two pullback tensors, pullback of S is likewise going to be bounded with respect to the pullback metric G. So the trace of S is in particular bounded above by some constant independent of, let me say, constant, in fact, depending only on that mu. And mu depends only on delta, so depending only on delta. Okay, so along our flow, what we've controlled is, let me just say in terms of the graphs, geometrically we've controlled the Hessian uniformly. In other words, we've controlled the gradient of the evolving graphs, and we're controlling the mean curvature of the evolving graphs. Now, by general mean curvature flow theory, all that's left is we just have to control the second fundamental form, right? And now here's where we use Yuan's theorem. Notice this condition being preserved for all t is saying that in Yuan's Bernstein theorem, we always have this hypothesis in his theorem. And what it essentially allows us to do is, philosophically, it allows us to control the mean curvature flow simply by controlling the mean curvature, which we're doing. So I claim that these two plus the Bernstein theorem of Yuan implies that third derivative of u in particular is less than or equal to some constant. Or let me first just say less than or equal to some constant for some constant depending only on delta. So the second fundamental form says uniformly bounded. To see this, you just suppose this is not true. Suppose the square norm, suppose the third derivatives blow up along some sequence in space-time approaching capital T. Well, then by centering around these points, focusing around these points, and dilating so as to make the third derivative equal to 1, we obtain, one can obtain, a limit entire Lagrangian submanifold in Cn. So this will be, well, one obtains a limit, subsequence limit. By our choice of dilating, we can have that the third derivative of this limit potential is equal to 1. On the other hand, if we blew up and the mean curvature was originally bounded, then we blew it down to 0. And this guy has mean curvature 0. So it's a special Lagrangian. This is a minimal. This limit is a minimal Lagrangian. On the other hand, it satisfies the conditions in Yuan's theorem. So that implies this has to be flat. But that contradicts how we took the limit, this being equal to 1. So by Yuan's theorem and a blow-up argument, we see this could not happen. In particular, third derivatives stay uniformly bounded by some constant depending only on delta. And in fact, slightly doing this a little more carefully, you can actually have that the third derivative has to be comparable to the size, what you'd expect it to be compared to the size of the mean curvature. So we indeed control the flow by controlling the mean curvature vector in this case. And like I said, just by general mean curvature flow theory, third derivatives here are equivalent to second fundamental form. You control that, you really control all higher derivatives. All the higher derivative control comes from general mean curvature flow theory. So in particular, all the derivatives of u are uniformly bounded independent of time. This solution, in fact, has to exist for all time. What we've actually done, if you look, is we've basically established the full conclusion of the main theorem under the assumption that there exists some short time solution to the theorem with bounded derivatives. And from this point, to establish the theorem then just amounts to making the following argument. So now suppose our initial condition u naught has Hessian only bounded in L infinity as it was in the hypothesis, then you approximate it by some sequence such that each of these guys have all derivatives order 2 and higher bounded, satisfying this initial condition. And one proves that for each of these nice bounded derivative approximations of our initial condition, one proves that you have a long time solution to the equation, a short time solution to the equation. By the a priori estimates, that has to exist for all time. And by the dependence on the a priori estimates only on delta, basically everything is in line to take subsequence limits converging on compact subsets in space-time in the appropriate norms when you include time equals 0 to get the solution to your equation, but emerging from your initial condition that you want to come from. So that's how the proof goes. One more thing I want to say here is, so there's a technicality. What am I doing here? I'm approximating my initial non-smooth guy by smooth guys with bounded derivatives. And by these a priori estimates, all I need to establish here is that for each of these, I have to argue I have a short time solution to this equation. This is a nice, strictly parabolic equation, but it's on a non-compact manifold. These guys are generally unbounded functions, right? Only their Hessians and higher derivatives are bounded. So it involves a little bit of argument, and basically we followed a proof of Hamilton's existence, short time existence for strictly parabolic PDEs on compact manifolds, and following that and adding in the necessary arguments in the non-compact case, one establishes this. Okay, so that gives theorem 1 and theorem 2. I already basically outlined the proof using the uniqueness result, and I think I'll stop there. Yeah, essentially the slope of the submanifold, yeah. Let me say I can't answer that question directly, but I can say the techniques we use are definitely, they don't even allow, even if we allow that delta to be zero, let the eigenvalues approach one, then the techniques kind of break down. So if at all, I don't know how I'd begin that proof, but I think it's not true, but I don't know of a counterexample.
There's a 15-minute break.